Welcome to Unforbidden Truth. I'm Andrew. On this week's episode, I'll be speaking with convicted serial killer Terry Blair. Terry was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri. He's the fourth eldest of 10 siblings. In August 1978, Terry heard gunshots right outside of his family's home. The shooter was Janice Blair, Terry's mother. She shot and killed her boyfriend, who was a known drug dealer around the area. Due to Janice's mental illness and taking an Alford plea, she was given 5 years probation and was ordered to get psychiatric care. Terry's brother Walter was arrested as a juvenile, though those records are sealed. While Walter was in custody, he met a man by the name of Larry Jackson. Larry Jackson was awaiting trial on rape charges. Larry allegedly had approached Walter because he heard that he was the man that got things done. He offered Walter $2,000 to get rid of one of the witnesses that allegedly made up these accusations before she had a chance to testify. After Walter was released from custody on bond at the age of just 18 years old, he had multiple telephone conversations with Larry Jackson, after which Larry increased the amount of money to $6,000 for the hit. On August 16th, 1979, Walter made his way into the apartment of 21-year-old Catherine Jo Allen and struck her in the back of the head with a brick. She had suffered gunshot wounds to her head, chest, and wrist, which was done close range. Larry Jackson is serving a life sentence for an unrelated murder. He was never tried for the rape or murder of Catherine Jo Allen. Walter was sentenced to death for that crime, and he was executed on July 21st, 1993. In 1992, Terry's half-brother, Clifford Miller, was sentenced to two life sentences plus 240 years for kidnapping and forcible sodomy. Terry's sister, Juanita, and her husband stabbed a man to death. She also suffocated one of her previous boyfriends. His death or survival is not known. Juanita's son, Diamond Blair, who's in the same prison as Terry right now, is also convicted of murder. Diamond has a lengthy rap sheet, starting at just 6 years old. Between the age of 12 and 16, he had various charges such as assault, grand theft auto, and running away from a court-ordered school for boys. 6 months prior to his 16th birthday, he caught a couple robbery charges and was tried as an adult. It's reported that while he was on trial, him and two other boys sodomized a 15-year-old boy. Diamond was sentenced to 18 years in prison at the age of 16. After being released from prison, on June 24th, 2009, Diamond and two accomplices shot and killed 22-year-old Montage Ashline in an attempted robbery. Diamond was sentenced to two life sentences plus 100 years for his role in the crime. Diamond Blair's brother is also a convicted murderer, though there isn't anything public about it, as he was a juvenile at the time. A defense attorney defending Diamond's brother was quoted as saying, "Even before Terry killed those seven women, his client was born into a family of murderers." In 1982, Angela Moore, Terry's ex-girlfriend and mother of his two children, whom was pregnant with a third child, was murdered. Terry was 21 years old at the time of the killing. According to court records, Terry was upset that she was engaging in prostitution. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison for killing his ex-girlfriend. In 2003, Terry was released on parole. On September 4th, 2004, two neighbors noticed two women's bodies in the garage of an abandoned home and notified law enforcement. The next evening, an anonymous caller called 911 dispatch to claim responsibility for the two bodies that were found in the garage and let them know where another body could be found, which was in an alley a few blocks away from the previous site. The same caller called 911 on September 4th to let them know the location of two more victims in an overground area near the highway and told them that he promised he would call again. The anonymous caller stopped contacting law enforcement after a news station had leaked information that the caller was using a cell phone. Police found several other murder victims, of which had previously been classified as a drug overdose, and several other women who reported rapes and assaults that were possibly linked to the murders. Each victim was found in a small radius near Prospect Avenue. Investigators narrowed their suspect list down, and Terry Blair was at the top of it. He matched the description given to investigators by multiple women who claimed that they had survived attacks at his hands. One witness claimed that he had threatened to kill prostitutes. Investigators weren't able to link Terry making the 911 phone calls, as the phone was stolen and it was only used to make emergency phone calls. Cell tower data showed that the phone calls were made near where he was living at the time. Terry was arrested on a parole violation for failing to stay in contact, and he was subsequently charged in the homicides. On October 15th, 2004, Terry Blair was charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of first-degree assault, and 3 counts of forcible rape. Prosecutors agreed not to seek the death penalty after Blair waived his right to a jury trial. Two of the murder charges, Sandra Reed and Neela Harris, were dropped. The rape and assault charges were dropped as well. Most of the evidence was circumstantial. Blair's DNA was found on Sheila McKenzie. On March 27th, 2008, Terry Blair was sentenced to 6 life sentences without the possibility of parole for the killings of Anna Ewing, Patricia Wilson Butler, Sheila McKenzie, Darcy Williams, Carmen Hunt, and Claudette Junel. Here is my interview with serial killer Terry Blair.
Hello, this is a prepaid collect call from...
Terry.
An offender at the Potosi Correctional Center.
Where were you born?
Kansas City, Missouri.
What was your first positive memory as a child?
Being in kindergarten. I mean, I remember as far as back as that.
What was your first negative memory as a child?
I can't remember what that would be.
Were your parents together throughout your childhood?
No. No, I grew up with my mother and my stepfather.
Were you close with your parents growing up?
Yeah.
What was home life like growing up? I know you come from a large family.
Home life, it was good. I mean, 6 girls, 4 boys, we all got along. It was good.
How was your mother with you and all the other children? Do you think she did a good job raising you all?
Yeah, she did the best that she could. I mean, I can't say a single mother, but she did the best that she could, though. But it being 10 of us, yeah, she did good.
In 1978, your mother murdered her common-law husband. Do you know what led up to that and what the aftermath of it was? And was that your father or any of your siblings' father, for that matter?
Stepfather, yeah, he's the father of one of my brothers and my sisters, but I don't use the word murder. She didn't murder him. It was an accidental thing in our view. So, you know, she had a problem at the time, so, you know, we don't consider it as being murdered.
One of your brothers, Walter Blair, was executed for a homicide he was convicted of, stemming from 1979. Were you close with Walter growing up?
Yep.
How did you feel when he was executed?
Well, I know he was accused of committing a crime. He never told me that he committed it, so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I was shocked, but I was hurt behind the accusation because it dealt with one of my best friends. But like I said, that was just one of those accusations that was made for whatever reason.
Your sister, Wernetta, also had trouble with the law. From what I've been able to find, and there's very little on her, she was involved in at least 2 homicides. Were you close with her growing up?
Nope. I've never met her growing up. I've never met her to this day. All I know is that they was born in Mississippi. Well, I was told that they was born in Mississippi, which is where my father was born, and a lot of my relatives on his side, and from my understanding, they are part of the family from my father's side, but I've never met her, though. I got like 20-something sisters that I haven't met that's on my father's side, so that's a lot of them.
You're a father and grandfather. Do you remember the feeling you had when your first child was born, as well as your second child and grandchildren, for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I was I was happy, you know, knowing that, you know, my daughters and my son, you know, had kids. That was my grandkids. I spent some time with a few of them before this incident. But, yeah, I feel good about, you know, them being my grandchildren.
In 1982, you were found guilty of murdering Angela Monroe in the second degree. Can you walk me through the events that led up to this incident?
That was an incident where my sons was placed in foster care. And I was sent a letter from the family services telling me that they was in foster care and they had a hearing coming up. And I just happened to run into her a few days after that and asked her about my sons, asked her where they at, where she said they were at home. And I knew that they wasn't, you know, and we got into an argument and this one thing led to another. And that's how that took place.
So you were sentenced to 25 years and paroled after 21. How did you occupy your time in prison? Did you do any type of rehabilitation classes or anything of the sort?
Yeah, I took a lot of, I took anger management. I took, it was a few, couple of other classes they have. I worked in a laundry. I worked in a metal shop making license plates. I worked in recreation, fixing on weight machines, work fire and safety, where I took, what do you want to call it, took training and fire behavior. I worked in the bakery. I got 7 or 8 different certificates for 10,000 hours as a baker and different institutions. So,
when you were paroled, how'd you feel?
It was a relief. It was getting used to things all over again. But it was good feeling, though, being away from the lockup and all the different things that took place daily.
What was the first thing you did when you got out?
Visit my family. We had a gathering, all the family, and had a welcome home party, and that was it.
How were you spending your time after being released?
Yeah, I worked a few different jobs. I worked at a shirt printing company where we printed logos on t-shirts and stuff, sweatshirts. I worked at couple of different restaurants. I worked the sanitation department. I had a few jobs.
On September 2nd, 2004, a neighbor smelt a strange odor coming from an abandoned house and stumbled across 2 bodies, and they notified the police. The next night, an anonymous caller called 911, and they had claimed responsibility for the murders and told police where they could find another body. Did you make this phone call? The anonymous caller would call 911 again, twice, letting them know where they could find more bodies. But they had stopped calling after the news station leaked that the phone calls were made using a cell phone. Investigators couldn't prove that you made the calls. They did locate a cell tower, and they tracked the phone calls, which was near where you lived, which was deemed a very important detail in your trial. What do you think of that being labeled evidence?
Well, what the cell tower did was recorded the coordinates is to those same locations and also different locations. You can make a phone call standing in one place and what they did was they made a phone call standing in one location and they got 3 or 4 different coordinates from that same location. And the original exact location that the phone calls was, that the coordinates of the phone calls came from, is the places that they went to. when they got to those locations, which was nowhere near where I stayed at, which was near the tower that they said, they got the same coordinates at that location, and they got different coordinates at that location. The detective claimed that he went in the locations of where my sister or my mom lived and made phone calls and got the coordinates from that phone call. And he also claimed that he got, according to the discovery, is 5 or 6 different coordinates from 16 phone calls, all from different locations. So they never got a coordinates from the location that I stayed at. They got that same coordinates that they got from the 911 call, they got from 5 or 6 or 7 different locations all over the city. And the detective saying that, well, I stood in front of it, it's possible that it could have came. It's possible that it could have came from anywhere, but they used the term possible. They never used the term definite to none of that. So the way they use it in evidence is it's possible that it could have came from that location. But, you know, so did 5 or 6 different coordinates from different locations. You know, also, you know, you would have to been in the trial to hear the testimony to understand, you know, the truth about that, and not just what they put on TV or in the newspaper. So, yeah, it wasn't surprising, you know, but it's what they do, you know. I mean, the detective who done the testing, I mean, it was learned that he lied to, you know, he falsified his reports on the testing to make it seem more accurate than what it really was. And even the judge mentioned that in his transcript of his findings. You know, the detective never told why he, you know, submitted certain things from his report, but more than likely to make it seem more accurate, which is what he did, you know. And because the information was turned over to my attorneys, and he couldn't used that testimony from his report on the stand, so he had to change it, and he just claimed like he made a mistake. It wasn't a mistake, it was falsifying evidence.
There is a woman that claims you tried to kill her and left her for dead, and after playing dead, she was able to get away. She claims days after the incident, she saw you, and you looked like you had seen a ghost.
According to the police reports, again, I got 5 different statements that she supposedly made. Each description of the person and of the events that happened is different. She got the person listed as 5'8", light-skinned. She got the person as having salt and pepper hair. She got the person as being dark-skinned. I don't think she know who the hell she's seen. Whatnot. According to other documents that I got, when she went to the hospital, it's listed as a domestic abuse, according to the hospital's report. According to 2 other witnesses, female witnesses that talked to her, it was a man and a woman that she encountered. At one time, she was carried to a garage and left. At another time, her and the person went to the garage to have sex, and that's when the events took place. So I've read all that, and I've seen all that as far as her saying that the next day she'd seen the person and that he seemed like he'd seen a ghost. Okay, that's possible. But according to her reports, none of them identified me, you know. As far as them having a picture saying that she picked me out of a lineup on television, they could produce the copy of that lineup that she supposedly picked me out of, where they signed it saying this is the person, circled the person who they picked out. They could produce that for my attorneys. But they also dismissed that charge due to the fact that they knew that this woman had all these different descriptions, all these different events, all these different police reports, and her credibility would have been, you know, tore up if she had went in the courtroom with that, because the things that people didn't know would have been brought out. Okay, I thought you said he was 5'8". He was light-skinned. I thought you said this. I thought you said that he dragged you, carried you, and you said that y'all went in there for the purpose of having sex. You said that it was a woman with him. You said that something about a truck, that they was driving in a truck. I mean, so I've heard that. I've seen that on the first 48, but I got the paperwork that says that contradicts everything that they stated in the first 48, if you want to put it like that. You know, I mean, that's a show. That's the way they do things, you know. But I got black and white that I can send you copies of everything that I'm telling you. And that's the facts in this case right there.
How do you feel about sex workers in general? Prostitutes, strippers, cam girls, so on and so forth.
I don't have a problem with them. I mean, that's their life. I mean, they do what they do. As far as I'm concerned, they are women and that's their way of survival, I guess. But I don't have no problem with none of them. I've dated prostitutes before. Before I went to prison the first time, after I got out of prison, I mean, I don't see nothing wrong with them. Like I said, I've dated a prostitute before here and there, and when they asked me about Sheila McKenzie, the one that told me my DNA on her, they asked me, did I know a woman named Sheila McKenzie? And I told them no, which I didn't know her name one way or the other, you know, that it was Sheila McKenzie, Sheila, or anything else. But once I said no, then they considered that I was lying, you know, that I was trying to hide the fact that I knew her, which I didn't know her, you know, and they showed me some pictures of different women, but they wasn't for sure if they showed me her picture or not, so they say, you know, so that was my reason for telling them that I didn't know her, because I didn't know her, you know, as far as whether I dated Sheila McKenzie or not, I couldn't have told them that either, you know, unless I'd seen a picture of her, and I don't know if, I guess I could have told them if I'd seen a picture of her, but, you know, it was a trick, one of them trick questions, you know, Sheila McKenzie, they don't know prostitute out there use their street name or their whole name, you know, to a person, you know, one way or another. They all go by monikers or whatever they call them, you know, like the one on television. The one that said she was left for dead, as far as police reports is concerned, she went by the name of Little Mama, you know, so don't none of them go by their street names to even ask a person something, let you personally know a woman by her name, and, you know, that was one of the trick questions they do, you know, according to police reports, DNA reports, that is, it was other men DNA found on her body as well as Caucasian men hair and everything else. So, and as far as my DNA was concerned, and as far as DNA testimony, my DNA was deposited anywhere from 1 to 2 days before she was found dead, where she was murdered. But the testimony was 24 to 48 hours before she was murdered. According to her mother's statement, she was at her house with her 3 hours and I think it's 40 minutes before she was found dead. So, you know, when you look at the differences between...
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
Between 24 and 48 hours and the difference between 3 hours and 40 minutes, it's a big difference. Big difference. And like I said, something else that they didn't say on TV, of course, is that other men's DNA was found on her body as well as mine, which, like I said, I got paperwork on all that as well. Or if you read a court transcript, you'll see the testimony on that issue.
You were picked up on a parole violation and charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder. What was the cycle of events like? Start with being arrested up until being charged with the homicides.
I was picked up, well, I was supposed to be picked up on a parole violation for leaving the honor center. whatever they call that deal when you leave someplace. But when they took me to the police department for questioning, the only thing that they wanted to talk about was the Prospect murders. You know, they didn't even mention the parole violation. They was talking about, hey, these murders, you know, do you have anything to do with it? Did you have a cell phone and this and that? That's the only thing that they brought up. But I was supposed to have been picked up for parole violation, but that's not what they started questioning me about when they got me down there, though. I asked them, did I need an attorney? And one of the detectives said, well, I can't give you legal advice. And I said, well, then I want an attorney. He said, for what? You're not being charged with anything. I said, well, I see where this is going. And they hushed up. They got a text message on one of their telephones. The guy read it. He left the room. He came back like 10 minutes later. I was still in there with the other detective, and he stopped saying anything. But when the guy came back in that left the room, then he automatically started trying to question me again. I said, well, I thought I asked you for an attorney. And they kind of looked at each other, and he just kept trying to go at it. So he was like, well, we found a big piece of tissue, and we need your DNA to eliminate you from, you know, if you didn't have nothing to do with it, then we need your DNA to eliminate you from this piece of tissue. So I gave him my DNA. Okay, well, I ain't got no problem with that. And I gave him my DNA, and then they just sent me on to the county jail. Cycle of events. I was just locked in a cell and waiting to be transferred to Department of Corrections for my parole violation. And then next thing you know, I see on the news that they was charging me with one count of first-degree murder. And you know, I talked to a lawyer, and then some few days or weeks or whatever later, then they were saying we're going to add 5 more murders to it because phone call. We're going to link everything together on the phone call. So that's how it went.
Have you cooperated with law enforcement at all with any of these cases or any unsolved homicides that you might be suspected of for that matter?
No. Once they took me in for the interrogation, and I asked for an attorney because of the way that it was, the situation was pointed, I never talked to them again since then.
Were you afraid that you might get the death penalty?
No, not afraid of it. I knew that, well, I knew that the death penalty was on the table, but I also knew that if they did the evidence and did the witnesses the way that the law, the legal process was supposed to go, that I shouldn't have had to worry about it, but it didn't go that way, evidently. But no, I wasn't concerning myself with it as far as the cases, you know, so.
You're ultimately found guilty and sentenced to 6 life sentences without the possibility of parole. How did you feel when you were handing down your sentence?
I didn't feel good. I mean, but I just figured, okay, well, I got my appeal processes, you know. I mean, this is what this judge came with. I listened to his reasons for coming with this. I knew that everything that he reasoned was against the weight of the evidence, and I just figured I'd deal with it in the higher courts.
Do you think you received a fair trial?
No. I mean, how can you receive a fair trial when you got something on television on the first 48, 3 years and something before you even go to trial? I mean, that got any jury bias, you know, if they believe in what they hear and what they see, like most people do. You got the judge who watched it, you know, it made him biased, you know, because that's what people do. They believe everything they see or hear on TV as if those people are right, you know, and like I said, according to the paperwork that I got, I could prove all of them to be wrong, you know, but that's not public information. That's stuff that got it, you know, and with me being the only one to see it and have it, I mean, it means nothing.
This call
to somebody,
is from a correctional facility,
you know,
and may be monitored and recorded.
And that's why they were able to do what they want to do, you know, unless, you know, I had a lawyer, you know, I had the money to pay a top flight lawyer who could present all that stuff, you know, put that stuff out there, then, yeah, I mean, they know I don't. So I'm on my own. So, yeah, that's the way they do things. You get, I mean, being in prison, you get used to it because you hear it and see it so many, you know, you're around so many different people and you see the same thing, you know, that they do to other people, you know, you read the facts, you know, that other than what you heard, you know, because read cases on other inmates, you know, but then when they show you the facts that they have, you be like, man, what the, you know, that's just the way it is.
Has there been any recent movement in your case, in recent years or currently for that matter?
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot, but I'm not going to talk about my my appeals process or as how I'm, you know, I'm going to talk about that. But, yeah, it's a lot of movement in it.
You've been incarcerated for 17 years now. You've spent a total of 38 years of your life so far inside a penitentiary. How do you not only keep busy on a day-to-day basis, but keep sane serving multiple life sentences?
In here, you're under certain rules and stuff like that, but in here ain't no different than out there. I mean, I watch the news, I see the foolishness that's going on out there, you know, the stress that people out there is going through, and it's no different. I'm good. You know, I can deal with it. I dealt with it out there. I can deal with it in here. I mean, it's nothing to stress you out. I mean, it's just life, you know, in here or out there.
Being that you have spent most of your life in prison rather than a free man, do you feel you fall under the category as somebody who is institutionalized and would remain to be institutionalized even if you were to be released somehow?
No, I don't think so. I don't know how people's definition of institutionalized is, but I wasn't that way after I did 20 years, so I wouldn't imagine I would be that way if I was to be free again. I'm not dependent on this system or the way that they do things or the food or all that. I know how to do a lot of things on my own, so I wouldn't think so.
Have you taken any type of classes or courses while in prison this time, whether that be anger management, furthering your education, so on and so forth?
I took anger management again. I took victims impact type of class. ICVC is what they call it. It's a victim impact course or something like that. I took that, and I took I can't remember the name of it, but it was something else that they had that I took. I took a computer skills since I've been here. So those are the only ones I took. I can't think of the other course that I took, though, but I took anger management, ICVC, and computer skills, and some other course.
I, like a lot of other people, learned about your case from the TV show, The First 48. The episode is called A Serial Killer Calls, I believe. I'm curious, have you had an opportunity over the years to watch that show? And if so, what are your thoughts on it?
I have watched it, and my thoughts on it is just a lot of cut and paste stuff. I mean, like I said, people in the world is not interested in the facts. They're not interested in the truth. All they're interested in is a ghost story or whatever the media say is the fact. When, like I said, out of all the people I've talked to over the years that I've been here now, not one of them, except one of them, have asked for the facts. asked to see paperwork, to see black and white, to see court documents, to see police reports. Nobody else have. Everybody else is just caught up in the first 48, the newspaper, what they say, she say, which they don't know nothing about my family. They don't know nothing about me. They don't know nothing. Actually, they don't know nothing about the case from what I seen on the first 48. Yeah, it was just to glamorize. They work for the police department. They glamorize the police department. You know, I got thousands of papers of tips from the tips hotline identifying different people. But according to the first 48, I'm the only suspect. I'm the only, you know, so, yeah, I've seen it, and it's a bunch of BS. A bunch of BS. No facts, no truth, no nothing. Just a TV show, something to draw attention, glamorize Kansas City Police Department. And just like the judge said, he watched it, and it's like he don't know if he's watching the Hardy Boys or Laurel and Hardy. So that's what I see.
Before we conclude this interview, is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
Not that I know of.
That was my interview with Terry Blair. If you haven't checked out my Patreon, head on over to patreon.com/unforbiddentruth. You can get access to additional interviews, a virtual true crime gallery, and much more. Thank you for listening.